My name is Daria Safronova-Semyonov. I am an archivist at Sinhermann Seminary, also an instructor of Church Slavonic and Russian Church History. And I also teach Russian at Kudia College. So, in a way, ironically so, maybe not ironically, but I continue the tradition of a Russian school on Kodiak, which is the longest educational tradition in Alaska.
Hi, you're listening to Stories from the Archives of St. Hermann Seminary. For our first episode, we are sitting down with seminary archivist Daria Safronova-Semyonov to hear about her recent trip off the island as she goes on her cross-country archival hop, a hunt for documents concerning Native education in Alaska at three different archives across the United States.
The whole purpose of my trip was to, well, first of all, I was doing a dissertation research, but this dissertation is about Kodiak and specifically the native people of Kodiak who were educated in these Russian schools, either in Kodiak or in Sitka or in San Francisco or in Unalashka, and came back to Alaska or to the villages where they were born and continued serving the church.
For those that may not know, Kodiak is an island located in the Gulf of Alaska. It is the second largest island in the United States, just barely smaller than Hawaii. The native people of Kodiak are Aleutic peoples, and that is what Daria will be referring to throughout this episode.
So why couldn't I do this research in Kodiak just asking around? Well, first of all, the tradition of Russian school goes back to 1802, right? We just don't have records of that school.
So just interviewing people here, you wouldn't have been able to get that far back.
Yes, but it is actually talking to the people here that inspired me even to pursue this very topic for my dissertation.
What is the topic of your dissertation? Do you have a working title?
Well, native literacy. Let's shorten it. Okay. Like native literacy of Kodiak Island, which means
the history of it.
The history of it, starting from the first school, which was, in fact, not in 1802 in Kodiak, but it was started by Grigory Shelikhov, who is some kind of suspicious character at this point, but it. He did start have a school in Three Saints settlement in Three Saints Bay. It's near Old Harbor.
Old Harbor is a village about 50 miles southwest of current town of Kodiak. Just south of Old Harbor is Three Saints Bay, and that is the site of the first Russian settlement.
So this first school where reportedly both Russian and Native children were educated was there. But still it is Kodiak that has this history of Native education. And I just think it is very important to put together the history of all these schools and bring again together the the matriculating records of all the Native students that graduated from all other schools in Alaska. Because at various points the main school shifted. Like let's say the seminary was in Sitka, and then School for Readers was in San Francisco. And I already know from the talking to our elders that some of the our Native readers, they studied in San Francisco. For example, Tichon Sharatin, actually know it from Shalamov journals. It's mentioned there.
The Shalamov journals that she is referring to are part of this project that she and Don Lee Black started at St. Hermann Seminary, where they've been translating these old travelogues from early original Russian missionaries that have come to Kodiak, specifically Spruce Island, and they document the journeys around the island, and there are never before translated documents that Daria and Don have been working to translate, and there are a couple that have been published and are on the seminary website. If you are interested in looking at those and reading those, you can find it at sthermannseminary.org.
Yeah, so it's all coming together, because when I translate the missionary travelogues, priests describe who they take with them. What is interesting that a priest, if he was Russian and not Creole, when they traveled around, they always had an interpreter with them, and sometimes confession was even done through a bilingual reader.
Usually a native.
Yeah, it had to be a native.
During the colonization of Alaska, Russians operated with three classes of people. Russians themselves, who actually were very, very few. Creoles, as Daria is referring to, that is the descendants of mixed Russian and native marriages, as Russian men willingly married into native villages. And then the natives themselves, which were the most numerous population. The Russian used the word Creole in Alaska as borrowed from Spanish colonial practices. They didn't have the class of Creole in Russia. There's a book called Kodiak Creoles that you can look up and read for more information. But this phenomenon was especially rooted in Kodiak because it was the capital of Russian America, where Russians were mixing and marrying into native communities. The descendants of colonial power looked down upon the native and the mixed Creole blood. But even in Alaska, in the village of Afognak, for example, there were two villages separated between the Creole and the native. The Creole was the colonial power. The Russians that came over were not actually pure Russian either, as it were. They were heavily mixed with Mongolian, and it was interesting that only in Alaska Russians had this distinction. But the moment someone was baptized into Orthodoxy, this person became a citizen of the Russian Empire, afforded all the same rights, and so when the Russian American Trading Company exploited the people in Alaska, it was technically illegal and a criminal act opposed vehemently by the Russian Orthodox Church, which is why there was such a conflict between the Russian Orthodox mission, specifically Father Herman, and the Russian American Company, specifically Baranov, who wanted to do things efficiently, but by doing things efficiently, that involved the enslavement of the native people.
This figure of a even trilingual reader really fascinates me, because this person could live in two or three worlds at the same time.
And this was exclusively because of Orthodoxy, right?
Yes, because that was the policy of the Russian Orthodox Church, to translate the services into native languages. And unfortunately, this tradition of educated native people was interrupted in early 1900s when Presbyterian missionary Sheldon Jackson imposed quite a different perspective. But, you know, we cannot vilify him saying that he was a monster. He just represented the policy of the time that perceived native people as the uncivilized other.
Sheldon Jackson was a part of a movement and belief that to civilize the native people, they should abandon all language and culture and spirituality, because he was a part of this humanitarian belief system that believed that Americanization was the key to the native people's future success.
Oh, yes. So children were sent to schools in Pennsylvania and Oregon to be educated as American children, and then they were sent back. And the repercussions of this approach are still felt today. There are some testimonies of Native people who were put through that, how they could no longer, how they were no longer perceived as Native by their fellow villages, and they could never overcome this trauma. It was done even in Kodiak. And again, we cannot say that those teachers were monsters. They thought that they were just helping their students and becoming acculturated in this way, so that they assimilation, so that they can socialize better and succeed. So they meant well, but unfortunately, what we have right now, almost a complete disappearance of native language.
So why did you go all the way to New York to do this research?
Well, first of all, I need to specify that this is not New York, New York. This is Syosset, New York. This is it's on Long Island.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So this is maybe 1 hour away from JFK Airport. And there is OCA, Orthodox Church of America headquarters.
How did they get there?
Oh, this is such a complicated story. The archives of the Orthodox Church in America are scattered, and there are three major repositories, I would say, of these archives. The major bulk of documents is at the Library of Congress. It's because of this librarian, Vinokurov, who collected church materials.
What was that name?
Vinokurov. And here, I forgot to mention another repository, it's in Juneau at the State Library. It's a Vinokurov collection. So, he collected all these archives and created a special collection within the Library of Congress collection. And, we can feel bad that the archives were taken from the churches. That's how I personally feel about that, because many churches, they lost all of their archives. And archives, what's that? It's not just paper, it's history. One day somebody gets interested in the history of their family or in the history of their parish, so they can go and dig in all those old papers. But when they're all taken away, what can they do now? Now they can go to the library and order a microfilm where all these archives are photographed and work with that. So in terms of preservation, yes, they were preserved. In terms of taking these archives from the smaller churches, you see, well, it's controversial. But my personal approach is that every village should have their own personal archive. For example, in the village of Old Harbor, there is a museum, now in Kodiak, there is a small museum at the rectory, and you can see the old books in Russian, and you can see gospel in Alutiiq, and you understand that these people had those books, and maybe it's only 1/8 or 1/10 of what they used to have, but someone was able to read that. So to me, personally, it means a lot.
Yeah.
What this archive is special to anybody who is an archival romantic, I'll put it.
The New York one?
The New York one. This is incredible. It's a dungeon. It's at the basement of this early 20th century mansion. And a small stairwell leads to the five rooms packed to the brim with papers that
boxes
represent
papers.
Yes, boxes. The boxes are filled with folders. The folders are filled with papers. And it's just incredible. So once you're there, you don't feel like leaving. Also, there is no daylight there. So it is a real dungeon.
But that would overwhelm some people. Like, some people would get stressed out with all those boxes there, not knowing where to start. Why is it different for you? Is it just in your blood? It's just...
Well,
so
well, I mean, stressed. I knew what I was looking for, and there is a perfect guardian of this archive, Archivarius. That's the one who guards the archive. Archivist is the one who works with papers, you know, and archive stuff. So Alexis Liberovsky, he is a long time archivarius / archivist of this archive, and he granted me access.
How long has he been there?
Well, tens of years. So he has been there for a very long time. He really knows it. Like with our archive that is not completely cataloged, it takes somebody who has worked in it and knows where folders are. So without him, it's impossible to navigate it. And he just knew what I was looking for, and he helped me immensely. He also helped me with the letting me scan the materials. He just started bringing box after box to me, and that's how I spent my day. Somebody would think that going to Long Island, I had some good time. Remember, somebody suggested going and eating seafood. Well, I had 8 hours of work every day, and then you breathe in. I remember the room where I was working, it just started smelling like old paper eventually. And you know, these days we travel, instead of trunks, we have these little flash drives. So I have basically thousands of papers in this little flash drive. It's pretty amazing. So now it is here in Kodiak, and now it will take time to decipher all of that. But I did see with my own eyes the signatures of literate Kodiak readers and staristas. And it was very special. I saw appointment papers of Kodiak priests. So basically the history of Kodiak Parish unfolded in front of me right there. And, you know, when you're already involved with the community, it really means a lot. Because you know the names, you know the family, and you know that it will mean something when you tell the story once you're back. One of the most precious finds in the archive in Syosset is the letters of Father Gerasim Schmaltz, who was a missionary priest and lived on Spruce Island. And he's very important for Kodiak history and Kodiak church history. And these letters were not translated, and we're looking forward to providing translation and starting this new project of translating Father Gerasim's letters.
Yes, where was your first stop on your archival hop?
It's a cross-country archival hop.
I like it. I love it.
Yeah, so it was in Juneau at the Alaska State Archives that has Vinokurov collection. And Vinokurov collection, it's this librarian from the Library of Congress who was the son of a missionary priest who collected all the church documents, specifically Alaska church archives.
His name was Vakurov.
Vinokurov. So the major bulk of this collection is at the Library of Congress, and it is microfilmed. But what he, for some reason, didn't have the time to process, or I don't know, have difficult time parting with, remained in his personal collection, and it is now in Juneau at the State Library, and they were very accommodating to me. I had only 2 days to work there, which is a nuisance, but that's what I had, and they pulled out all the boxes that I asked about, and even though I had only 2 days, I did find some treasures. Actually, I found another travelogue of Tikhon Shalamov.
Oh.
Yes, from 1899, if I'm not mistaken, handwritten. So this is...
So earlier than the ones that we have.
Yes, so it would be very interesting to see, and it is thick, and I photographed it, and
did you ask them for when you went? Did you say, I want stuff from Kodiak, or...
Yes, well, they didn't have it specified, they just had it in boxes in years, and... According to topics, they couldn't just produce something about schools. Mm-hmm. So I had to... And this is the most exciting hunt, when you just have a box with
like
years...
Like Google searching in real life.
Yes, and you just go through all the documents. And it takes... Of course, it takes longer. There's no way you can quickly go through all the documents. You have to read at least a couple of sentences from mm-hmm. what it is.
So you're just looking for keywords?
Keywords. Well, I knew what I was looking for, school records. Again, this is my, mm-hmm. right? Any kind of school records, but or anything that is related to Kodiak. And but I think the most precious thing that I found in Juneau was that journal by Tikhon Shalamov, that we can translate it and add it to our collection of translated journals.
Yeah, really exciting.
Yes. I even called my co author and said, guess what, Dawn? And I told her, guess what? And she said, oh. You know, yes, I cannot wait to actually go through that and translate it. So it was very precious.
So you went Juneau, New York, then where?
After New York, to finish my transcontinental archival hop, I went to Fort Ross, 2 hours drive from San Francisco. But with traffic jams and inexperience of the driver of these three-dimensional roads, it took 5 hours. And I'm grateful to be alive. It's a miracle. It's because I asked people in Kodiak to pray for me to come back. I think that's the only reason I'm back, because it was very dangerous. But the true treasures are discovered only through suffering and through exposure to danger. So I made it there. And actually, since it got dark while I was getting there, I had to sleep in a car on the, very romantically, on the banks of the Russian River. So,
perfect.
As a true romantic, I reunited, I have a picture of that also, I reunited with the Russian past.
In California,
yes. And then I made it to Fort Ross, and I walked around early. I was the only one, because I came so early after my sleepover at the bank of the river. It was very special just to be in the place where life was so abundant, because there were many people there. But again, I was especially interested not in Russians who were in Fort Ross, but in the Aleutic people. There were 118 Aleutics living in Barabras, on the cliff, in front of the fortress. So basically, we're talking here about the whole Aleutic village in Fort Ross. And there is a cemetery there as well, where Aleutic people are buried, and Russian people. And so how interesting, like what started in Kodiak, continued in Sitka, and then was transferred to Fort Ross.
How did they get to Fort Ross?
Oh, in kayaks.
What? Well,
some of them on ships, the lists of ships, but Aleutic men, they came in kayaks, and some of them, they came all the way to San Francisco.
That's down the coast.
We know that Peter the Aleut, he's the motto of San Francisco, just going down the coast. And that's what I was thinking about when flying back. Here I am. It takes 3 hours to fly to Anchorage, and then 1 hour to fly to Kodiak, and they made it all in kayak.
How long did that take?
Well, I have to look at the records. There are records that say how long it took them.
Wow.
But the fact that I found extremely fascinating, that Kodiak men, they married into the local native culture, Kashaya, California natives. And I was thinking, how interesting Kashaya. Yeah, how interesting how colonization goes. Here are Russians coming to Kodiak, but they're not exactly Russians. So many of them are Siberian people who were, you know, colonized by Russians who came to Kodiak. And here is the turn of Kodiak people to repeat this process and to come to Kashaya people, how it's all connected. Well, and one can perceive it in a negative way or in a positive way, but to me what was interesting that this fact happened. We have this Aleutic village right there, and we have Aleutic people buried with Russians in Fort Ross that is so far
and native away. California natives.
And California natives. It's
that's amazing.
It is incredible. Well, so,
because I'm from California. Yeah. And here I am.
Yes. Well, I was looking again for the same thing, because in some of the Russian sources I read it that there was a Russian school in Fort Ross. And, well, there is nothing right now in official documents, so it will take some extra digging to find that. But I think if there is a huge probability that the school was there, because if there was a school in Three Saints Bay when Russians just landed, then the same kind of mentality would probably continue there, and I would be surprised if there was no school. But at least it will take more digging. But again, people there, Sarah Switler, the director of the museum, and Hank Birnbaum, he's a bilingual interpreter for Fort Ross. They were again very welcoming to me, gave me access to this conservancy, and were very helpful. And again, I had to tell them this. I mean, this is a routine phrase for me now. Well, I'll have to be back.
Was he bilingual in Russian and English?
Yes, yes. So his story is actually similar to mine, because he went to Russia and married a Russian woman. So I came here and married an Alutiiq man. So he is bilingual and bicultural. And, well, I told him I'd come back, but I really want to come back with my husband and my son, for them to see Kodiak, Alutiiq history in Fort Ross. Like, can you imagine how far the Alutiiq ventured?
Yeah.
Yes, and they're still there, because, you know, if you believe in the presence of the Barabras, the place looked perfectly fit for Barabras. It looks like Akiok, in some ways, that grassy knob where the Alutiiq village was.
Barabras are sod houses that the native peoples lived in, and Akiok is the remote village on Kodiak Island where Daria's Alutiiq family is from. It is surrounded by rolling tundra.
So I think that there is still work to be done about the spiritual reestablishment of Kodiak people in Fort Ross. Mm. Like that, knowing that there is one more Alutiiq village there, and some Alutiiq people.
I was gonna say, are there Alutiiq people living around there?
No, they all left once the fort was sold. Everybody went back to Alaska. Yes. Well, so this was the shortest stop on my in my.
Was this shorter than the Juno stop?
Yes, that was only one day. At least in Juno, there were 2 days. So in a way, it was archival scouting.
Yeah.
And how did you feel as an archivist representing St. Herman Seminary?
Well, to tell you the truth, I felt important because I was I represented the seminary, and I was introduced to other people in all these archives as the archivist of St. Herman Seminary Archive, and I really treasure this position. This is one of the most important positions I've held in my life, because, and I see my role model maybe in Alexis Liberovsky, who is both an archivist and archivarius, the keeper of the archive. And even any thoughts that I ever have about going back to Russia, I think, well, how about the archive? No.
Can't leave the archive.
I cannot leave the archive.
This archives. Is your other baby.
This is what happened to me when I came here, and Father John first showed me the archive, and I held these books and I couldn't let go. You know, I felt like I'm ready to stay here right now. So this was the greatest magnet, and being able to read these documents that are there, because they are written, most of them are written in Russian, so in a way having this, putting it romantically, linguistic key to this archive, this is very precious to me personally. And so, to put it to an end to my speech, you have to cut this one out. In conclusion, I think it was a very important hop because it connected our archive to some of the scattered Alaska archives, and I hope the hop continues.
You hope the hop continues.
But not as a hop, but this time maybe as a crawl. So that there is one, the major archive, the one in Washington, D.C. Well, I think it is very important to bring together all those stories that are reflected in the papers, and there is lots of work to be done, and our seminary is in a perfect position to educate future archivists who can come to the seminary, research our archives and other archives, and return back home as historians of the parish.
I love it.
Okay.
Brilliant. What can people listening who want to maybe become more involved in and learn more about what you're doing here in the archives, what can they do?
Call the seminary, schedule an appointment, and they will be given a detailed, lengthy archival tour. And if they're from Kodiak, they might go back with some names of their ancestors. Or if they're from somewhere else, they just we can discuss how to their historians. Well, we can discuss possible projects, right? But I think it's important to come and see the archive, because without seeing, you know, it's just an archive. But once you see and you personalize it, right, you connect to those documents, and there is always, in all these boxes, there is always at least one document that will open your heart. Yes.
That will speak to you.
That will, yeah, that's a, that there is always one document that will speak to you personally and will send you on a search or hop.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Thanks,
well,
Daria.
That's a lot, huh?
Whatever.
For you, I broke the lock and buried the key. Come find.
For listening to this episode of Stories from St. Herman's Seminary Archives. We hope to continue producing more episodes as the school year begins and progresses in the next few weeks. Thank you especially to the Wild Reeds for providing music for this episode. You can find them at thewildreedsmusic.com. And also a special thank you to Daria for interviewing with me and to St. Herman Seminary for producing and publishing this podcast. I hope you all have a wonderful day. If you have any questions or comments, please, we would love to hear from you. Email us at office@stHermanSeminary.org. That's office@stHermanSeminary.org, or call the office at 907-486-3524. Hope you all have a good one. Bye-bye. Bye.
And still, there will be more news about what is about the treasures that were brought, because each document has a story behind. So stay tuned.